People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this special edition of PTR, we present a speech given by Dr. Kevin Danaher, co-founder of Global Exchange.
And look what's going on right now. You've got the far-right fundamentalist faction of the three major monotheisms, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, and it's a 5 or 10% minority, really, in each, that is willing to kill innocents and justify it by saying, God says it's okay for us to kill innocents. It's a tiny minority in each faith. And they want to fight it out. Hey, you want to fight it out? Fine. Go out to one of those islands in the Pacific that you irradiated with nuclear testing. We'll strip you down naked. Osama bin Laden, Bush, Sharon, and you can duke it out. You know, and maybe after you pummel each other enough, you'll overcome your homophobia and love to learn to love one another, you know? Easy for me to say. You know, don't put me in the middle. Don't put my children in the middle. Don't put my relatives in the New York area or wherever in the middle, okay? Let's not go that route.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Dr. Kevin Danaher, Global Exchange's co-founder and director of public education, has been traveling across the country talking to people about how a renewed commitment to social justice and human rights are essential for eliminating terrorism. Dr. Danaher is also the author and/or editor of some 11 books, including his latest, Democratizing the Global Economy, and others, such as Corporations Are Gonna Get Your Mama and 50 Years Is Enough, The Case Against the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. Dr. Kevin Danaher spoke in March of this year on the topics of the domestic, environmental, and human cost of globalization at the First United Methodist Church Social Hall in Sacramento, California.
Let me just start with a few words about Global Exchange. We're a nonprofit human rights organization based in San Francisco. We do reality tours. We do fair trade. We've got stores in San Francisco and Berkeley where we sell crafts from third world development groups. We publish educational materials. We have a very active website. I'm happy to announce that our website is up over 2 million hits a month now. We got, when my wife Medea took a delegation about a month ago over to Afghanistan, a victims delegation. It was family members of victims from September 11th going over to meet with victims of the U.S. bombing. We got on, you know, all these CNN, NBC, the Today Show, all that, and we got up to 95,000 hits a day on the website, which is good because a lot of this is just regular TV viewers. They hear the name Global Exchange, they type it in, and then they come across all sorts of information. We literally have thousands of pages of information on the website. And one of the things we do off of that website is we do an email listserv on all sorts of different subjects. So I'd like to circulate some of these sheets. If you have email and you want to put your email address on the sheet, and then over on the right-hand side of the sheet, you'll see different subject areas, Cuba, Mexico, Brazil, World Bank, IMF, whatever. If you're interested in those subjects, check those, and we'll be happy to add you to the mailing list. We don't spam people. About once a week, maybe twice a week, you get information from the Global South, from the grassroots, action campaigns, ways you can get involved and do stuff in your local community to make a difference. Our main purpose is to try to reach Americans, to educate people in this country, by Americans I mean U.S. people, about what our real responsibility is in the world as the most powerful nation, as the richest nation in the world. We're 4% of the world's population, and we're consuming about 25% of the world's resources. That's not sustainable. A lot of people would say it's not right, it's not moral, and we need to do something about that as citizens. People have been taught to forget that we have four branches of government in this country. We were taught in school there's three. There's not. There's four. There's the executive, the judiciary, the legislative, and then the fourth branch of government is supposed to rule over those other three branches, and that's we the people, the citizenry. The highest position you can hold in a real democracy is that of citizen. The President of the United States and every other public official underneath him works for us. Bush lives in public housing. Okay? It's fancy public housing, but it's public housing. We own it. We own the White House. All those documents that Dick Cheney doesn't want to reveal to the public, we own those documents. We own the computers and the notepads and the tables and the pens and everything that was used to create those notes. We, the people, own those. There's an incredible amount of arrogance going on right now in our government, which is frightening the hell out of me, and I don't scare too easily. I've been in some scary situations. You know, we could be going toward, like, outright dictatorship in this country, and we need to wake up to that fact. Because you can say all you want about democracy, democracy, democracy. When you have somebody in the White House who wasn't elected by the people and got the Electoral College votes of the state of Florida through illegal behavior, and that's all coming out now, how they rigged the ballot boxes, how they eliminated African-American votes, how Jewish voters voted for Buchanan. Excuse me? You know, there's a book out, Jews for Buchanan, about the whole election and the way it was stolen. So we need to be asking some very serious questions and not being intimidated by people who are, you know, putting out this crazy notion that if you question the president, somehow you're unpatriotic. No, it's your patriotic duty to question government and to criticize authority. That's the role of a citizen in a democracy. In our Declaration of Independence, it says that when a government is not meeting the needs of the people, it's not only the right of the people, it's the duty of the people to overthrow such a government. That's the verb that's used. Overthrow. Okay? That's not me. I didn't say that. That's Thomas Jefferson and the other people. Thomas Jefferson said in the early 1800s, when he was president, he said, "I hope we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of the powerful corporations which already bid defiance to our government." Right? Already, 200 years ago, at the founding of the Republic, very bright minds were saying, uh-oh, we better look out. They're trying to take over the people's government, and we can't let them do it. So I think we need to be in touch with the fact that a lot of people throughout history have warned us about this kind of stuff. FDR said, whenever you have private power take over the people's government, that's called fascism. When private powers take over the government away from the people, that's what's called fascism. Now, obviously, he was saying this in the 1930s. He was not referring to the United States. He was referring to Nazi Germany. But I think we need to, I'm not a fear-monger. I'm not an alarmist. But I think we need to wake up and look at what's going on. All of this repression of civil liberties. You know, Ben Franklin had that great line about people who are willing to trade off civil liberties for temporary security deserve neither security nor liberty. Now, not exactly a dumb guy, Ben Franklin. So what we do at Global Exchange is we do a lot of different programs, books, the website, corporate accountability campaigns, fair trade movement, educating people and mobilizing them to protest the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, as a way to say, look, there's two ways we can go. We can go money values and have the corporations rule the world, or we can go life values and have the people, the citizenry of the planet, make the rules. And that's basically the choices. It's minority rule or majority rule. And I want to just hold up for you here, sorry to the radio audience, this is a visual. This is my nonverbal theory of international relations. The big triangle is a nation. The little triangle up at the top of the big triangle is the ruling elite, the corporate leaders, the politicians, and the generals. They have relations with the military, political, and economic elites of other nations. So in the case of Argentina, for example, it's in the midst of an economic crisis. You get IMF and World Bank loans. That's what these lines are, connecting the elites. They give these loans to this country. They have to pay back with interest, so it sucks money out of that country and takes it upward in the global class structure. But the key thing about those loans is the policy control. They're not giving the money. They're giving it with strings. And they say, okay, we'll lend you $39 billion. That was one of the IMF loans to Argentina. Wow, 39. What do I got to do? What you got to do is run your national economy in a way that allows outside big U.S. corporations to come in and get two things. Labor at low wages, thank you very much. Not a lot of unions. We don't want that kind of stuff. And natural resources. If you got trees, we want to cut them down. You got coastline, we want to fish the hell out of it. You got minerals, we want to rip them out of the ground. And what do we see in the planet? We see a fisheries crisis, a minerals crisis, a forestry crisis, etc. What we do at Global Exchange is we try to expose those transnational elite alliances, the money values that dominate the planet, and at the same time build these grassroots transnational linkages, the People's Global Alliance or People's Globalization. Because in the media, they talk about globalization. When they're talking about globalization, they're talking about this top-down elite globalization of the minority. And it's about money values. And actually, it's a whole paradigm that is a composite of money values, violence, God is on our side. And if you think about it, Osama bin Laden and George Bush have the same paradigm. Money values, Osama bin Laden, oil millionaire. You know, we got two violent oil millionaires fighting it out with us as the innocent victims in the middle. When I talk to general public audiences, I say, okay, I'm going to describe somebody. You tell me who it is. Somebody who came from an oil millionaire family who believes it's acceptable to use violence against innocent people because God is on his side. Who is that? Or Osama bin Laden? I don't know. You know, I mean, they're both saying the same thing. Now, when Osama bin Laden kills people in New York and Washington, he says it's okay because they're infidels. They don't believe the same religion as him or the same brand, the same far-right Sunni Wahhabi Islam as him. Bush, over here, we're taught to not, we don't say infidels, we say collateral damage. Collateral damage. Well, those collateral damage, they have a face, they have a name, they have lives. I'll give you one example. On the second, we've done three trips now of groups from the U.S. to Afghanistan. On the second trip, my 21-year-old daughter was doing the video on this, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. A 12-year-old girl tells the story of how she was out for a walk with her father. They came back. Their home was flattened by a U.S. bomb. Not all our bombs hit their targets. Yeah, that's right. Thousands of innocent people in Afghanistan have been killed, homes destroyed, hospitals, clinics, apartment blocks, etc., destroyed by U.S. bombs. She comes home with her father. The house is destroyed. Their mother is killed. The father goes crazy. He's now totally debilitated, can't function. This 12-year-old girl now is responsible for raising five younger siblings. I'm sorry, I have an 11-and-a-half-year-old who's very smart and talented. She could not raise five younger siblings. That is just wrong. And the U.S. government is trying to say, we have no responsibility to those people. So what we've done is we've set up a No More Victims Fund where we're educating people about this, showing them the faces of the suffering, and saying, look, we have a responsibility. It was our tax money and our bombs that did this damage to these people. It was our leaders who carried it out. Our military who did it, whether it was intentional or not, it happened. Cluster bombs. I've studied this. It's a big canister that releases hundreds of bomblets that spread out over the ground. It's like a tennis ball. And these bomblets, it's Minol, high explosive, inside a metal canister that's got serrated grooves in it. So when you touch it and it blows up, you've got razor blades flying at 1,000 miles an hour. It'll penetrate 4 inches of armor plate. It was designed during the Vietnam War by our corporations to take out truck parks and tank installations in Vietnam. You know those Vietnamese people who were threatening us? What? Huh? Excuse me? Vietnam? That little poor rice agriculture society the size of Florida? They were a threat to us? No, but because they wanted to run their country on a different economic system than us, we had to kill millions of people. That's what radicalized me when I was a teenager. My government did me the favor of trying to send me over there to kill people who I didn't know, who I didn't want to know, who couldn't hurt me, wouldn't hurt me, didn't want me coming there, etc. And enough of my buddies had already come back saying, don't go, man, don't go. And that's what woke me up. But is that what it takes? Are we going to have the draft and body bags and all that kind of stuff before people wake up again and say, wait a minute, war is wrong. War is wrong. Violence is wrong. if violence worked as a policy, this policy Bush is doing, if that policy worked, kill. If that policy worked, Israel would be the safest place in the world right now. Because that's what Sharon has been doing for, what, over a year now. Kill them. You kill two of us, we'll kill 18 of you. You kill three of us, we'll kill 27 of you. And what that means is you're planting dragon's teeth. You're sowing seeds of hatred, resentment, animosity, and there's more people now who hate us than before September 11th. I'm not saying don't do anything, but think, when September 11th happened, our leaders had an opportunity. They could define it as war and bark back at the dog and do to them what they did to us and kill innocents, or they could go the route of justice and say this is a crime against humanity. We need an international system of justice. We need to get all governments to collaborate in bringing these people to trial. And we have two pillars of our system of jurisprudence in theory. One is innocent until proven guilty, and the other is truth, whole truth, nothing but the truth. Well, let's have truth, whole truth, nothing but the truth. And anybody, I don't care who they are, what their religion is, what country they come from, anybody that was associated with the violence of September 11th should be put on trial and hopefully put in jail. Anybody. I don't care. I don't care who they were. I don't care if they lived here. I don't care what physical package they are, how they worship, whatever. Because what's happening is we're starting to find out there are some very questionable lapses in U.S. security, in investments that were made in United Airlines and American Airlines. Some very strange things went on. I'm not saying there was a conspiracy or anything. I don't have that evidence. But there's enough facts out there to have me as a scholar say something stinks. I've interviewed military officials in Washington, high-level military officials, who have said something's wrong here. Something stinks. Because it doesn't take you 40 minutes to scramble planes around the Pentagon. There's Fort Myers. There's Andrews Air Force Base. They're within a few nautical miles of the Pentagon. And there was about almost 40 minutes between the second tower being hit and the Pentagon being hit. And that plane came in so low, it clipped the telephone wires before it hit the Pentagon. That was a very, very professional flight. My 11-year-old daughter said, Daddy, if 15 of the 20 guys were from Saudi Arabia, how come we're not bombing Saudi Arabia? I mean, not that she's in favor of bombing, but she said, well, why Afghanistan? Yeah, this guy is based in Afghanistan, but these guys were Saudis who did it. Oh, but Saudi Arabia's got all those oil fields. Yeah. Now, think about this. In the 1930s, when the U.S. government and the British government put the House of Saud, the House of al-Saud, in power in Saudi Arabia, it's the only country I know of that's named after a family, right? Saudi Arabia, the House of al-Saud. It's like if somebody came here and imposed a monarchy here and we had the United States of Rockefeller. Yeah? It's like, would we put up with that? I don't think we'd put up with that, right? So, and none of this is to justify what these people did on September 11th. There is no justification for killing innocent people. So, what bothers me most about when I give public talks, people say, are you justifying? There's a difference between an explanation and an excuse, okay? If you're trying to find causal roots of something, you're not justifying it. You're trying to examine the basis of how did it happen so you can prevent it in the future. Just going out and killing people, dropping bombs, shooting missiles, is not going to solve the problem. You either kill mosquitoes with a hammer or you dry up the swamp from which the mosquitoes generated, right? And there's enough inequality and environmental destruction, et cetera, in the world to generate plenty. What surprises me, in a sense, I'm not wishing this, but what surprises me is, why is it that only one region of the world has generated people willing to come to the United States and kill people? Central America. We killed a lot of people in Central America. We don't have Christian fundamentalists coming from Nicaragua to blow up buildings. We don't have people coming from Vietnam, right? I mean, in a sense, we lucked out that only one region that we messed over decided, hey, we got to take it to them, right? Again, I'm not justifying it, but we need to educate the American people about what U.S. foreign policy has been about. And what it's been about has been supporting all sorts of scumbag dictator elites who are willing to collaborate with U.S. corporations sucking wealth out of their country. And I know it from Africa. That's where I did most of my work. The most suffering, The most injustice and environmental destruction occurs in the same locations where the most natural resources are. South Africa, all that gold, half the world's gold, you got apartheid. At least you did up until recently. Nigeria, it's in the Niger River Delta where you've got most of the oil. That's where most of the suffering is and most of the environmental destruction. People say, but Kevin, why is that? It's because it's an extractive model. If I'm a transnational corporation, the only reason I invest in your country is on the sure presupposition that I can extract more wealth than I put in. Duh. Otherwise, why would I do it? It's not a charity. I don't want to leave money in your country. I want to take money out. Look at Argentina. That's been run under IMF World Bank policies now for decades. Of course, there was the generals, the dictatorship, the mass killing of leftists. But for the past 10 years, they've been linking their currency to the dollar, and the policies all came from Washington and Wall Street. Set your interest rates high to attract the international banks. If you raise your interest high to attract international banks, what does that do to the local worker that wants to borrow money to buy a house or a car, or your small business person that wants to expand their business? They can't get a loan. It shuts down the Main Street economy. So you're sacrificing Main Street for the interests of Wall Street. So here you have a country, Argentina, it's the size of India with the population of California, very lightly populated, good agriculture, good industry, highest literacy rate in Latin America. Why should there be an economic crisis in that country? They should be very well off. Mexico, there should be nobody forced to leave Mexico. It's got good farmland, lots of resources, oil, talented people, vibrant culture, good climate. There's no reason for there to be inequality and poverty. But if these elites who make national policy are getting their directive, it's like if the people who run Sacramento were in the pocket of corporate... Oh, well, no, let's not go in that direction. Because they are, yeah. And that's what's happened. Our own elites, look at this Enron thing. The majority of members of Congress took money from Enron. And it's not, let's face it, it's not just Enron. Enron was the kid that got caught red-handed with his hand in the cookie jar and got stuck, right? Oh! And the shocking thing is not all the laws they broke, it's how much they got away with that was legal. Because they had already gotten the politicians to defang the regulatory agencies. Just like recently you saw the Senate shot down an effort to raise auto fuel efficiency standards. Our fuel efficiency standards have been flat for two decades. They haven't gone up. Does that have anything to do with those big campaign contributions that Ford and General Motors and Exxon? No. Now, if you go into the U.S. Federal Criminal Code, it's not the most exciting reading, but if you go into the U.S. Federal Criminal Code and you read the Federal Criminal Code, and I forget the section number, I have it written down somewhere, it's very instructive. It says, and I just might check here and see if I have it. I don't. But it says, it is against U.S. federal law. It is considered bribery. If you give anything of value to a public official expecting anything in return, or if you're an official and you accept anything of value and do anything in return, well, that's basically the whole system, right? The whole system of our political system of all this money, money, money is illegal. It's in violation of the Federal Criminal Code. And this is why the corporations always say, oh, we don't expect anything from that money we give. Well, then you're an idiot. Right, so you're either lying or you're an idiot. Which is it? Right? But they're both. They're lying idiots. They have to say that to protect themselves legally. Because the law states, if you expect anything, or if there's the expectation of you as an official doing something in return, that's illegal. That's a violation of federal law. So we're confronted on the planet right now with three major crises. There's a social crisis of inequality. The inequality is so extreme that we have more children dying each year in Africa from AIDS than died during the entire Holocaust in Europe, each year in Africa. By the way, we all come from Africa, okay? That's where we all come from. That's what the best science tells us right now, is we originated, this human race, our species, came down out of the trees in Africa. That's where we all trace our parentage to. And yeah, we went out to Asia, Latin America, Europe, etc. And some of us went to cold climates and our pigmentation thinned out, etc. But we all come from Africa. What's the most suffering part of the planet right now? Africa. So what does it mean for the spirituality of humankind that the worst suffering is in our ancestral homeland? This is not an issue for African Americans alone. This is an issue for the entire human species. That we have more children dying each year in Africa from AIDS than died during the Holocaust. What do we think now on the good Germans who did nothing against Hitler? We say, ooh, those people, ooh, they're morally bankrupt. How could they have stood by? And someone said, oh, we didn't know. And we say, oh, that's no excuse. You knew. Everybody knew. Well, what's going to be said about us 30 or 40 years in the future? You're going to say, you didn't know about that stuff in Africa? Those kids dying of AIDS? Where there was medicine available, and both the Democratic and Republican politicians in this country fought like hell to keep the government of South Africa for generating its own AIDS drugs, which South Africa is capable of. It's got a big industry, but they fought against it because the pharmaceutical companies that give them big campaign donations said, no, 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 that we have the patent on those drugs. They have to pay us the monopoly patent rights, that tax. Is that moral? So you see what's going on is it's a struggle between money values and life values, human rights and the environment. And what they're saying, the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, they're saying subordinate life to commerce. And we're saying, no, subordinate commerce to life. And all you have to do is ask a public audience, which is sacred, commerce or life? People know the answer. Life is sacred. Commerce is just one human activity. It's an institution. It's like sports, religion, schools. There's all sorts of different institutions. But life is sacred. Life is the gift of the Creator. Or if you don't believe in God, it's the life cycle, the gift of nature, right? That's what's sacred. So that's the question that's confronting us. And the composite paradigm that's dominated for 500 years is money values, violence, God is on my side. And what we're saying is life values, nonviolence, God does not take sides in intra-species conflicts. Right? I mean, think about, thank you. If you've got a conflict between red ants and black ants, God is on our side, God is on our side, God is on our side. You know, if you overheard that conversation, you would say, oh, you ants are so stupid that you would think that the creator of all life, of the entire universe, would take sides in an intra-species conflict? And look what's going on right now. You've got the far-right fundamentalist faction of the three major monotheisms, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, and it's a 5 or 10% minority, really, in each, that is willing to kill innocents and justify it by saying, God says it's okay for us to kill innocents. It's a tiny minority in each faith. And they want to fight it out. Hey, you want to fight it out? Fine. Go out to one of those islands in the Pacific that you irradiated with nuclear testing. We'll strip you down naked. Osama bin Laden, Bush, Sharon, and you can duke it out. You know, and maybe after you pummel each other enough, you'll overcome your homophobia and love to love one another, you know? Easy for me to say. You know, don't put me in the middle. Don't put my children in the middle. Don't put my relatives in the New York area or wherever in the middle. Okay? Let's not go that route. If violence worked, we would have had peace in the world by now. Okay? We've had all these wars, and what it does is, it's great for the weapons industry, it's great for the generals, they got their cushy jobs, their nice big houses in Chevy Chase, Maryland, walking their poodles at night, all that kind of stuff. No, that's not what we need. We need schools, we need clinics, we need solar energy, wind power. You know, wind power now is competitive with burning dead dinosaurs, fossil fuel use. If you go to Germany or Denmark or the Netherlands, or even here in California, thank you, Jerry Brown, Governor Moonbeam. Yeah, he was the one that put in those windmills, right? We're the leading state for wind energy. The estimates are that Texas, Oklahoma, and North Dakota could provide enough energy, wind energy, for the entire country, just those three states. There's farms now in the Midwest that are earning more money from renting their sites to wind energy turbines than they make from farming. Says something about our farming system. So We've got a social crisis of inequality. We've got an environmental crisis of every major biological system being in a state of collapse. Topsoil is being eroded faster than nature can replace it. Groundwater being depleted and poisoned. Ocean levels rising from global warming. I mean, think about this. When Miami goes underwater, when Key West goes underwater, oh, baby, yeah, then they're going to pay attention. So what's going to happen, and this is not Kevin Danaher speculating, this is what's going to happen. The environmental crisis is going to drive people to our movement because we're the ones that have been saying for decades, hey, people, wake up. You cannot keep binging and not get a hangover. And nature eventually, nature bats last. Nature's the home team. Always. Nature has the last word. Anybody who thinks otherwise, you're kidding yourself. And we're seeing, there was a storm a year and a half ago in India, killed 10,000 people in one storm. There was a storm that hit France coming off the Atlantic, knocked down 5 million trees in one day. That's like 5 years of logging in one day. Right? So as that kind of stuff, as Mother Nature starts to go, ah, get out of here. You humans are crazy. You're poisoning me. Right? And starts to shake us like the fleas that we are. It's going to force people to question the money ideology. The money ideology that says a 1,000-year-old redwood is not a gift to the creator. It's $300,000 worth of lumber. No, you're wrong. And you look at the popularity of people who go and sit themselves up in trees to protect trees, right? Well, is there the similar popularity for the guy that goes out with the chainsaw and cuts down? No. There's not. There's not a lot of young people saying, wow, man, I want to be like those chainsaw guys. You know, what a role model. They're not getting big book contracts like Julia Butterfly Hill. Right? Yeah. So you see, it's starting to tip. It's starting to shift. And that's what I want to focus the rest of my comments on.
You're listening to a speech by Dr. Kevin Danaher, co-founder of Global Exchange. This is People's Tribune Radio.
Look at these movements. I'm just going to touch on three that we're involved with at Global Exchange. The corporate accountability movement. People are realizing that we need to democratize not just the capital with an O, but the capital with an A. Right? We have to force change on these corporations, and I mean nonviolent change. But what we've shown is you can do it. If you mobilize enough people and you can hurt their profits, you can hurt their revenue, you can force them to change their behavior. Starbucks didn't want to start selling fair trade coffee. When we first went to them and we said, hey, we'd like you to sell fair trade coffee because the farmers get paid $1.26 a pound minimum and the world market price is below 50 cents and they get help going organic. It's shade tree production. It's good for the environment, good for the farmers. They get help forming co-ops. We give them credit, all that. You know what Starbucks said? They said, kiss off. There's the door. Get out of here before our security guards throw you out. We said, okay. We'll launch a nationwide campaign with protests outside all of your cafes, and we'll talk about sweatshop coffee. And when Medea raised that issue in a Starbucks shareholders meeting, we always buy shares in these companies so we can get into the shareholders meeting. And I always wear a suit and sit over with the suits so I can get up and say, oh, come on, give them what they want. They're going to drive down our profits. I'll lose money. You know? Oh, God. That's their frequency, right? If you don't get on the right frequency, you're not going to hear the show, right? Because you watch the suits in these meetings, and when the human rights and environmental activists get up to do their spiel, my wife, God bless her, you know, they get up to do their spiel, and these guys are like, oh, man, you know, they're watching a fly crawl up a drape. They're bored. They want to see this. Shut them up, will you? Yeah, but they're stockholders. We got to let them speak, you know? It's our fake democracy, right? One day a year. So what we did was we said, okay, we're going to launch a campaign in 30 cities, and we're going to give you a little whiff of what we're going to do. So we did one protest in San Francisco with just our staff. You know, and we got like 42 staff now. So at lunchtime, we said, okay, today at lunchtime, we're all going to go down to the Starbucks on 4th Street and do a little demonstration. We had the signs, sweatshop coffee, which we got the sweatshop coffee from the shareholders meeting when Medea got up and made this speech and said, look, do you want your company to be known as a purveyor of sweatshop coffee? All the shareholders, Ben Arroyo Hall in Seattle, 3,000 seats, they all go, boo, hiss. Oh, thank you very much. You just told us what our slogan should be. Sweatshop coffee, right? So we go out there with the signs. a guy who was at the WABC affiliate in San Francisco who had been to Guatemala and was doing a show on the conditions of the workers on the plantations. Whole family, kids, husband and wife work all day. If they really break their backs, they can make $3. These kids should be in school. These kids don't have shoes. There's poison spiders, poison snakes. This guy was heartbroken. He wasn't a radical guy. He went and filmed, and he was politicized by what he saw. Just coffee beans. You could have picked chocolate. You could have picked Nike sneakers. You could have picked a lot of things. He picked coffee. So he was doing the show. Anyway, he came and integrated into his critique of the plantation conditions. Us in front of the Starbucks, we sent the tape to the Starbucks executives in Seattle, said, here's a whiff. Here's a little taste. You want this in 30 cities? Fine. We're a corporate accountability group. That's what we do. Make my day. Slap me in the face. Show me the door. Go ahead. Or would you rather have us go bug some other company? About a week before we launched the campaign, they sent three of their top executives to our office, and they surrendered and gave us what we were demanding at the time. Now we've ratcheted up the demands to say, look, we don't want you to just sell the beans. We want you to brew it up, because the idea is to raise the sales. If you think of commerce as this river, we're trying to put a sluice gate in there and shift the money toward the good stuff at the bottom. Solar energy, organic agriculture, sustainable, you know, community supported, co-ops, democratic, empowerment of women. This is all basic stuff. It's out there. People know how to do it. It's our job in the rich countries to shift it, right? And you don't do it as an individual. You do it in an organized way as part of a campaign. So you've got the literature, you got the website, you got the media outreach, the op-eds, the letters to the editor, the legislation in the state legislature, in Congress, etc. Because people say, oh, what? I'm only one person. What can I do? What am I, Siamese twins? Everybody's only one person, right? It's when we group together like fingers into a fist that you have power. Fingers are breakable. Fist, a little bit harder. I apologize for the militant analogy, but, you know, you could say playing a piano if you want to or whatever. A bouquet. What makes a bouquet beautiful? It's the unity of diversity. Now, think about this. What gives us strength as a country is not our missiles and aircraft carriers. That's not why people respect us in the world. They might fear us because of that. The reason why people respect us is, one, we're the most diverse country in the world. The United States is the most diverse country ever in world history. That's our strength and our belief in fundamental human rights. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All people, they said all men, they meant all people. They didn't say all Americans. All people are created equal, and they're endowed by the Creator with inalienable rights, which means they cannot be taken away and they cannot be given up. If you want to give up your freedom of speech, you can't do it, because it's an inalienable right. And among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If your children are starving and they're crying at night, Mommy, I'm hungry, Daddy, I'm hungry, but you had to pay the landlord the rent on your one-acre farm, and you're growing export crops for the rich of the planet instead of food for your kids, you cannot pursue happiness. That's what the pursuit of happiness is, the economic rights that are guaranteed to all humans in the 1948, thank you, Eleanor Roosevelt, Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And there's dozens of them. Just Article 23. Every human being has the right to meaningful work. Everybody has a right to a job. If we just implemented Article 23 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it would require a revolution. And that's what we're talking about. And I know that it's kind of ironic that for a country that was founded on a revolution, people are afraid to use the word. But that's what we're in the middle of here, is a global revolution. Every previous revolution was a national revolution where the goal was seizing state power in the capital city. Notice back in 94 when the Zapatistas rose up in southern Mexico, they didn't say we want to seize power in Mexico City. They rose up against neoliberalism. They rose up against global capitalism, against this top-down transnational elite minority globalization based on money, values, and violence. That's what they rose up against because their kids were hungry and their forests were being cut down. Who wouldn't rise up? And the basic attitude is, I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees. And I guarantee you, I have two daughters. I would rather sacrifice my life. I'd rather have needles stuck in my eyes than have my children suffer and cry out to me and me not do something about it. That's something any parent can understand. When your child, my kid gets a nosebleed and I freak out. Oh my God, what am I going to do? Great. Ah. Yeah, why? Because you love that person. Well, shouldn't we love all the children of the planet that way? I think this struggle comes down to redefining the word our in the phrase our children. Our children, my children aren't the two kids that live in my house and I have to write checks for. It's all the children on the face of the earth. And if there's one child dying from measles or some other disease where the vaccine costs 10 cents, I can't rest. I shouldn't be able to rest. Now, I got that because I traveled a lot in Africa. I worked in refugee camps. I watched kids die. I saw parents try to throw themselves into the graves of their children. You see that kind of stuff, it changes you. It changes you down at the cellular level. It's not intellectual. It's down in the marrow of your bones. After that, you're not going to become a drug addict or an alcoholic or, you know, get lost in consumerism because you've been focused by that fire of pain and suffering and injustice, and you know it's wrong. So I'm actually, in the work I do, I'm just saying thank you to the people who let me share that injustice with them and helped me to make a promise to do something about it. Maybe not able to stop that immediate case 15, 20 years ago, whenever it was, but in the future. And that's the struggle. You can dive into the river and save every individual drowning child. If you don't go upstream and get the son of a bitch who's throwing him in the water in the first place, you're not going to stop the problem. You've got to get at the causal roots. Yes, you got to do charity. You got to do the immediate put out the fire. But if you don't get the guy who's setting the fires in the first place, you're not going to solve the problem. You're not going to get at the roots. That's what the word radical means. It comes from the Latin word for roots, like radical surgery. You get the whole thing out. So the first piece of this global justice movement is the corporate accountability movement. It's spreading all over the world. Monsanto is being trashed by Indian farmers and people in Brazil and France and the United States. Nike sweatshops. All these companies are being exposed. Granted, we haven't taken away their corporate charters yet. We haven't gotten a constitutional amendment yet that says a corporation is not a human being. Simple, seven words. A corporation is not a human being. I want to see these bought and paid for members of Congress get up in the floor of the House or Senate and say, a corporation is a human being. Duh, no, sorry, not true. I like Jim Hightower's idea. Politicians should be just like race car drivers. They should have emblems and logos of the corporations on their suits that give them money. Right? Simple. Say, okay. If you're going to get this money, then you should at least have to identify so those of us who you're supposed to be working for, public servant, can at least tell, oh, yeah, he's got a big Exxon, and he's got Chevron, he's got Shell, and okay, we know who he's. Oh, and there's the senator from Tobacco Land. Yeah, you know, and then we would know how to deal with them, right? It would make it a little easier. Second piece is the movement struggling to democratize global government. We do have global government. It's not the UN black helicopters that the right-wingers are so afraid of. It's the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which is an attempt to expand NAFTA to the whole Western Hemisphere. If you look at the record of NAFTA, it's very clear. It's not about U.S., Canada, Mexico. Did the U.S. benefit? Did Mexico benefit? No, that's not the way you understand it. You look at it sectorally. These elites in Canada, Mexico, and the United States all benefited. The middle class in all three countries got screwed. The working class in all three countries got screwed. But the transnational corporate banking elite, they did great. Because who is it that moves money and stuff across borders? I don't do that, right? I'm not looking to set up a factory in Mexico to build cars at $1.35 an hour for the workers. No, that's not me. That's these people up at the top that run these big corporations. So they shut down a factory in Detroit, 5,000 workers laid off. They set it up in northern Mexico. They hire 5,000 workers who they pay $1.35 an hour. Those Mexican workers are not going to buy the Ford Taurus coming off that assembly line. And they're not making enough money. The unemployed workers in Detroit sure as hell aren't going to buy those cars because they're on unemployment. Ford or General Motors or whoever's doing that moving of factories, they're assuming they can sell their product to somebody else's workers. But if all these big corporations are doing the same thing, what you end up with is a lot of unemployment and a lot of unsold stuff. Each year in the world auto market, 2 million automobiles go unsold. That's efficient? Hey, capitalism, it's efficient. It's not efficient. Our agriculture, heavy capital investment, machinery, chemical agriculture, it's efficient. One farmer used to produce enough to feed 20 people. Now one farmer produces enough for 60 people, whatever. And people see that as a sign of progress. It's not. Because what that means is you're taking farmers that inherited from their father, grandfather, etc., who could go out and pick up a handful of soil and smell it and tell you what it needed. And you're replacing that family farmer, owner, operator with a tenant farmer who's working for big agribusiness inside an air-conditioned cab listening to music going foo, 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 across the land, compacting the earth, spreading deadly chemicals that's killing all sorts of flora and fauna, poisoning the groundwater, and eroding the soil. We lose enough topsoil in the United States, at least 2 billion tons. That's the low estimate. I always use conservative statistics because I believe in conserving. It's kind of funny that the United States has conservatives running the country, but they don't believe in conservation. Yeah, there's something weird about that. Are you a conservative? Yes. You believe in conservation? No. Okay, maybe I'm using the wrong dictionary. I don't know. If you took the U.S. topsoil that's lost each year in the United States and you could capture it and put it in big 40-pound bags and charge just $5 a bag, you could make more money than all the profits of all U.S. farms combined. That's how much topsoil we're losing. I'm not talking about water pollution. What's the number one source of water pollution in the United States? Agriculture. Huh? Species destruction. Farmers on food stamps. States where farmers are the number one occupation for suicide. No, this is crazy. And a country that was founded on the family farm? God help us. So, the second piece of this movement, democratize the global state. The World Trade Organization in particular, it's why we did these protests in Seattle when they made the mistake of meeting in Seattle. It was the only time they met in the United States, and I guarantee they will never do it again. World Trade Organization is writing a constitution for the planet. That's what we're in. We're in a constitutional moment. Think about the 1780s in Philadelphia. If we had been able to have more than rich white males at the table making the U.S. Constitution, we wouldn't have had this thing about African Americans are 3/5 of a human. The Electoral College? Anybody here ever met an elector? Who? Let me guess. Let's see. Do the Electoral College people come from up here in the class structure or down among us regular folks? You know? Why is it secret? Why is the institution that chooses the president a secret to the people? You can go out and test it on the street. Ask people, what's the Electoral College, and see if you can get one correct sentence. It's just like the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization. Try it. Go out. Ask your colleagues at work or friends. Say, can you tell me anything about the World Trade Organization? It's about trade? No, it's not about trade. It's about writing laws for the planet that will subvert our national, state, and local democracy. The corporations learned many years ago, civil rights movement, anti-apartheid movement, women's movement, anti-sweatshop movement, Central America Solidarity Movement. They understood that we were using law to protect human rights and the environment against the profit-seeking that they do. So they said, how can we create a way to run an end run around the law, around constitutional authority of a democracy? Let's create a planetary authority that will subordinate lawmaking by the people to commerce. And that's what they've done. If you look at every single case that's been ruled on by the WTO, and there's a book that does this, it goes through it, Lori Wallach's book, Whose Trade Organization, WTO, Whose Trade Organization. They go through every case. And people say, rich countries benefit, poor countries benefit? No. Who benefited, government or corporations? Governments lost in every case, corporations won. Corporations won. The sea turtles, right? We get restrictions on shrimp being sold in the United States that's caught in nets that kill the sea turtles, right? Because the sea turtles are air breathers. They've been swimming the ocean since before the dinosaurs. They get killed by these nets. So people say, okay, look, unless you get a $400 turtle excluder device. It's a grate that lets the shrimp through and catches the sea turtle, kicks it out. Unless you have a turtle excluder device in your net, you're not going to be allowed to sell that shrimp in the United States. Sounds fine to me. It goes to the WTO. The shrimp companies take it to the WTO. WTO says, no, that law, that U.S. environmental law, is WTO illegal. You got to get rid of it. Oh, so we, the American people, don't have the right to pass a law protecting a species that predates the dinosaurs, and it's going to get overruled by corporations who don't want to spend $400 to include a device that's going to save those animals? I'm sorry, I'm a sea turtle. I'm going to stand up for my brother and sister sea turtles. I'm closer to them than I am to, you know, Ken Lay and Enron and, you know, these other people who are so junkied out on money. You know, like Ken Lay, he had to sell one of his houses in Aspen for $10 million. Aww. You know, it's like, dude, how many houses do you have that are worth $10 million, you know? I don't know. Dianne Feinstein has a house up in Aspen, too, by the way. I saw it. It's a really nice house, in addition to the one she has in San Francisco. That's a nice house, too. But, you know, we know how to get to her. So that's the democratize the global state movement. People are saying, okay, there's going to be global government. And in my new book, this book, 10 Reasons to Abolish the IMF and the World Bank, I talk about this. You know, we can have global government, but it's different to have a federation of locally empowered communities that choose representatives, and then global government only decides on things that are truly global. Global warming, mining the deep sea oceans, acid rain that crosses borders. Everything else gets decided at the lowest level possible. You push decision making down as close to the community that's impacted as possible. So if there's going to be a stop sign on your street, or if there's going to be a factory shut down in your town, you who live there decide. The way it's structured right now, the people who make mass transit policy never ride the bus. You realize? In San Francisco, the guy who runs Muni gets paid $150,000 and a car. You know, it's like, why give him a car? Give him a pass, right? The people who control public housing, you think they live in public housing? Right? They live up in Black Hawk up on the hill. They live in gated communities in big mansions. Right? The people who make energy policy don't pump their own gas. The chauffeur does it. So if you don't have a feedback loop, if you have an interruption between the policy makers and the impact of the policy, of course you're going to get bad policy. And that's not about left and right. It's about up and down. And that's part of our job, globally and locally, to redefine politics from left and right to up and down. I love going on conservative radio, Christian radio, talking to conservative groups and say, let's talk about fundamental values and democracy and what democracy means and what we need to do as citizens of a democratic republic. It means the people should rule. Do the people rule or do the corporations rule? Everybody knows the answer to this. It's evident. Kids know it, right? The third piece of this new values paradigm, this global values revolution, and I'll conclude with this, I promise, is the alternative economy, the life economy. We're doing a thing in San Francisco in November. Mark your calendars. November 9th and 10th, San Francisco Concourse, the Green Economy Festival. We're bringing together hundreds of sustainable agriculture, organic food, wind energy, solar energy, Greenpeace, Rainforest Action Network, all the people that want to build an alternative economy, because all the pieces are there. You can find carpet companies that when you're done with the carpet, they'll take it back and recycle it into new carpet. Every piece of the economy, whatever, transportation, energy, housing, food, there is an alternative institution doing it in a sustainable, fair trade way. But we haven't yet made it a system. We're at the second stage. It's not just solar companies. We now have solar associations and wind energy associations, sustainable agriculture associations, certified organic, etc. So we're at the second stage. The next stage is the system level, global system. And say, look, we can create, you know, it's how we got from feudalism to capitalism. People said, this feudalism stuff, let's do it a different way, right? That's how every innovation gets created. It's human beings like us saying, hey, you know what? We don't have to do it this way. We can do it a different way. That's our ability. So whatever sector you look in, you see there is an alternative life values economy being constructed. So the key thing for us, I think, as individuals, is to realize that we have a cult of powerlessness in this country. The cult of powerlessness says, I'm only one person, what can I do? I like the one, you can't fight City Hall. Right? You'll never hear a millionaire say you can't fight City Hall. Yeah? The millionaire says, secretary, get me the mayor on the phone. Mayor, what the hell are you doing? You're blocking my condos with these stupid laws. I gave you $10,000 in the last election. Yeah? Rich guys never say that. They say they do action. Right? And we're, oh, you can't fight City Hall. If you have a revolution, the new leaders will be just as corrupt as the old one. You know, it's all this very self-serving ideology that for those of us who live in this affluent part of the planet, it's very much like the right-wing minister who sits on the Anti-Pornography Commission. He gets to look at it all and enjoy it and denounce it. Yeah. So we get to benefit from imperialism and the extraction of wealth from the rest of the world. The richest 20% of the world's people account for 86% of resource consumption. That means the poorest 80% of the world's people get 14% of global resource consumption. That's a UN composite of food, energy, wood, metals, minerals, everything. That's why children are starving to death one every few seconds. Okay? And we benefit from that. Whether we like it or not, whether we voted for it or not, whether you voted for Bush or not. No, that's not the issue. We're benefiting. So it's not just the people in the SUVs. It's all of us. We all benefit. So we don't want to be like that right-wing minister on the Anti-Pornography Commission. We want to go out and we want to change this. And I find heartening a quote. I'll leave you with this quote from Martin Luther King. In fighting this cult of powerlessness, we all have it within us to reach out to other people and to build a movement that can create this global values revolution. Martin Luther King said this. He said, the ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate it.
Dr. Kevin Donahue, co-founder of Global Exchange, from his speech given in March of this year in Sacramento, California. You can get more information about Global Exchange at www.globalexchange.org. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. PTR is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same tools of computerization, robotics, and electronics, which are being used to displace millions of workers around the world, are used for the benefit of the planet as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League or our other print or audio publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888, 1-800-691-6888, or on the web at www.lrna.org. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.